This talk I probably never have completed actually fully because I like to have a lot of interaction questions with this talk because we're talking about antiarrhythmics and things we do and things we use to treat them and other options that you have available. So if you have any questions, just don't feel free to pop your hand up and ask a question. There's how many of you guys used? And you notice I scratched out some of the company's names here and cut them off if I could. But how many of you guys use computerized ECGs to help give you a diagnosis? These guys. Well, notice what I have circled in this case. Who wants to be our brave soul and say what the diagnosis should be for this case? Anybody? Well, if you let this top thing fool you, you might get bucked down into saying this is VPCs and you listen to the recommendations that come out with this computer printout that says treat this case with lidocaine. But in actuality, this is a dog that has third-degree heart block with ventricular arrhythmias. Something I always teach some of my students that you need to basically be able to read your ECGs for yourself and not depend on a computer. And unfortunately, this gets past even some of the people who are supposedly reading these and sending these back to you. So you have to be able to say, okay, wait a minute, this is not quite right in these guys. This is a dog that obviously the P waves are marching in and out of this QRS, and this is a ventricular escape rhythm. So with that in mind, I always talk about approach to ECG, and just kind of as a quick review before we get into actual treating these arrhythmias, always, for me, these are important things that you have to be able to do. Note the basics of your ECG, meaning your paper speed and sensitivity, so you can calculate heart rate. And if you're fancy and want to calculate chamber enlargement, you can go ahead and do those things if that's possible. Obviously, the rhythms are very important. Noting whether the rhythm is regular or irregular, meaning do I have a lack of interbeat variation, or am I getting irregular beats, meaning I have some variation in my R to R intervals. And if I do have that irregular beat, is it regularly irregular, meaning is there a pattern to that, meaning do I see three beats, then two beats, three beats, then two beats. That's more consistent with respiratory sinus arrhythmia in dogs especially. Or do I have a very irregular pattern, meaning irregular rhythm with no pattern to it, which is more suggestive of advanced arrhythmias such as atrial fibrillation or even multifocal VPCs may cause this type of arrhythmia. Identifying your waveforms are very important. Make sure that you have a P, QRS, and T. If you're having trouble identifying your waveforms, advice I always give is to find a T wave. Okay, use multiple different leads if you have to, but identify the T wave. Look back the interval that you would expect the QT interval to be, which is usually around 180 milliseconds, and that's probably your QRS, and then prior to that is most likely your P wave. Okay, sometimes the waveforms are all equal in height, and it's very difficult to assess that, but your intervals, your cardiac intervals, can help you out in identifying your waveforms. Then ask yourself certain questions. Do you have a P wave for every QRS and a QRS for every P? And are they related? Meaning that, yes, I see these P waves and I see this QRS, but are they related to each other? And if I go back to that other view, you can see here, I have a P wave that's falling right before my QRS, but do you really think that P wave is driving that QRS? The answer to that should be no, because if it was, it would probably change the shape of that QRS complex compared to the ones that don't have a P wave in front of it. Okay? These are important basics to kind of keep in mind when you're looking at these guys. If I see any complexes, do I see any complexes that have a QRS or without a P wave? Do I want to look to see if they are earlier or late complexes? And if they are earlier or late complexes, I want to assess whether they are supraventricular or ventricular in nature. How do I do that? Anybody remember? Somebody, yes, exactly. Look at the morphology of your QRS complex. A narrow QRS complex tends to mean supraventricular origin, whereas a wide, bizarre one tends to mean ventricular origin. There are some caveats to that. If you have some bundle branch block disturbances, you may get some get fooled on that, but those are rarities. And remember, we talk about common things occur commonly. A wide QRS early or late QRS is either a ventricular premature contraction or a ventricular escape rhythm. And then for diagnostic ECG, you actually want to calculate your mean electrical axis, measure your waveforms, and measure for chamber enlargement, and give a proper diagnosis so that you can get so you can apply proper treatment to your patients. If you apply lidocaine to that previous patient, you're probably going to kill them. Okay, that rhythm is there for a reason. So understanding the heart rhythm means understanding the normal heart cycle and the things that are present. If you look at your normal peak conduction pathway, you have your sinus node starts the ball rolling here, causes your P wave as atria depolarize. Your PR interval is that interval in the where 75% of that time is spent in the AV node. Allows conduction down to go down the ventricles through the His-Purkinje system and the bundle branches evenly throughout the ventricles so that you get your QRS with depolarization and your T wave with ventricular repolarization. The normal pacemakers of the heart are also somewhat important to remember. Remember, you have three areas of the heart where you have cells that have automaticity. And what you have here is a diagram that shows the difference between pacemaker cells here, cells that have automaticity, and cells that need a stimulus to fire. You have three groups of cells that have that automatic ability. The sinus node, and the sinus node tends to be the one that overrides the other two areas because it fires the fastest. It's like that classmate that you had way back when that asked the question that you want to ask because they were overzealous. They'd always raise their hand. And so they overrode your ability to ask a question and get any attention in class. Well, that's the same thing happens here. The sinus node drives that because it tends to beat at 140, 160 beats a minute. The AV nodal cells also have cells with automaticity in them. But their intrinsic rate is only about 60 to 100 beats a minute. As well as the cells within the Purkinje system that have ability to fire on their own spontaneously, but their intrinsic rate is only about 30 to 40 beats a minute. This is a backup system that we have that allows us, in case the signal doesn't get down, gives us redundancy to be able to have the heart do its job and contract and push blood out. So if you have a patient that has suppressed SA node function or blocked at the AV node, you want to see these rhythms come up in order for the heart function. You don't want to suppress those rhythms in these guys. Okay? So treatment of arrhythmias in general, I always think about these. You always have to wonder, start with assessing your patient and not just the ECG. What I mean by that is, does this arrhythmia have hemodynamic consequences, or does it have the ability down the line to develop or create hemodynamic consequences for that patient? If so, I want to be aggressive at treating that patient. If it tends to be one or two arrhythmias here or there and doesn't seem to it's going to cause them problems, then maybe you want to back off on treating these guys. Most of the antiarrhythmics that we have also do what? Cause arrhythmias in these patients. So you have to be somewhat careful with what drugs you're using and what you're using. Are there underlying causes? Meaning, has there been any trauma, electrolyte disturbances, or intracardiac diseases present that are causing these arrhythmias to occur? Are there any drugs that are on board that also may be causing this? If so, antiarrhythmics may not be necessary. Treating the underlying causes may be the bigger benefit to you than anything else. And then having some understanding of arrhythmogenesis in that understanding what's causing arrhythmias. Arrhythmias can occur secondary or to one of three phenomena, either abnormal automaticity, so cells that have the ability to be automatic either gain enhanced automaticity or they lose their ability to be automatic, or cells that normally don't have automaticity gain the ability to become automatic, okay, to automatically depolarize the heart outside of that conduction system. Trigger phenomena occur most often secondary to drug therapy, such as digoxin. These require that a cell has been depolarized, and then while that cell is repolarizing, the cell becomes unstable and reaches threshold again and stimulates the heart cycle again. And then you have what we call reentry circuits. This is probably the most common cause of arrhythmias in all of medicine, not just veterinary medicine, but human medicine also. And we'll talk about what that is in a few minutes. Just because you have one of these doesn't mean that that's the only mechanism. Oftentimes, one of these may lead to another mechanism actually developing down the line. But then also you also have some understanding of your antiarrhythmics, the classification scheme historically, some of the pharmacokinetics and dynamics, and some of the side effects of these drugs. Now, I'm trying to take this talk beyond just saying, okay, class one drugs are sodium, potassium, sodium blockers. You use these for these arrhythmias. What I'm going to show you is what we do as far as using these for certain arrhythmias, and then some other techniques that are out there that may actually obviate the need for antiarrhythmic therapies in some patients if we can use them. But just as a reminder, the predominant the classification scheme is based on the predominant electrophysiologic action of these drugs. Most of these drugs do have multiple class actions and will stimulate multiple systems in the body. So they may have effects outside of just being a sodium channel blocker as class ones, or class twos being beta blockers. Class 3 drugs. Class 3 drugs are especially the ones that are messing with this classification screen system, because most of these drugs actually have multiple class interactions, very strong multiple class interactions that we see in these, we're using these drugs. Then class 4, the calcium channel blockers, and we often use others to help control the heart rate. And some people call digoxin a class 5 antiarrhythmic also. Some other housekeeping things, the term ectopic beats. Okay? The term ectopic beats is often misused. And just to classify what that definition is, these are any beats that originate away from the sinus node. They may have very fast or very slow rates. They can be junctional in nature, or they can be ventricular in nature, junctional or supraventricular. If they're junctional in nature, they have a typical normal narrow QRS complex, whereas if they're ventricular in nature, they have a typically wide and bizarre QRS complex. Ectopic beats can also be early, meaning they could be premature. So prior to the regular sinus beat or the expected normal sinus beat, these come in, instead of having bump, 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 you just have bump, 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 bump. They're coming in a lot earlier than normal. These tend to compromise ventricular filling, especially when you get at very high heart rates. Once again, they could be junctional or ventricular in nature, okay? Or they could be late, an escape beats. These can occur secondary to long pauses, or occur secondary to long pauses in a sinus beat, or in cases of AV block. So with escape beats, you always have a primary arrhythmia followed by an escape beat. So you have two diagnoses that you have to give with this. So you have third-degree heart block plus either ventricular or junctional escape, or you have sinus arrest plus junctional escape beats or ventricular escape beats. Okay, so these will always occur secondary to a pause. Subsidiary pacemakers will then take the place of whatever's causing the delay. If the sinus node is not firing, maybe your AV junctional cells will start taking over, or the Purkinje fibers will take over. Once again, life-sustaining rhythms, we don't want to suppress those with antiarrhythmics as opposed to our earlier premature beats. Just quickly, some of the selected bradyarrhythmias that we see. A number of our bradyarrhythmias are incidental findings, most are secondary to increased vagal tone as the underlying cause of these patients. Which means that if we remove that high that cause of the high vagal tone, or we treat with parasympatholytics, we resolve that arrhythmia. We don't need any advanced other antiarrhythmic therapies in that case. Oftentimes, electrolyte or endocrine abnormalities may also be the underlying cause of some bradyarrhythmias, or drug toxicities may also be implicated. Once again, you remove that underlying cause in these patients, and thus you don't really need an antiarrhythmic for that patient. More advanced diseases, however, are associated with disease or destruction of the sinus node, or the SA node, or the AV nodes. Okay? So that's when we start to see patients that probably need either drug therapy or actually need pacemaker therapy. And these tend to result from either disorders of impulse conduction, meaning that the impulse can't get through the conduction system where it should, or disorders of impulse formation, meaning that impulse is not developing at all, so that those cells that typically had automaticity are now basically not doing their job. They're sitting around waiting for something else to fire. Okay? In these patients, this is known as decreased automaticity in these guys. So in this case, we have a patient that has a nice long pause here. You see he has a pause with a negative P wave in front of his QRS, a negative P wave again, a pause, a negative P wave here. Then we have a positive P wave and a positive P wave, then a nice long pause. And then we have this little beat right here. What do you guys think that is? Escape beat. And based on its morphology, it's narrow. It doesn't quite look like these other complexes, but it's nice and narrow. So it's probably a junctional escape beat in this patient. Okay? I tell you, this dog, this is a short script from a dog that had 5 to 7 second pauses and was having syncopal episodes. We were actually echoing this dog, and the heart would just basically stop. And you're sitting there like, holy crap, and the dog would basically sitting there looking at you. And like, are you going to pass out? So this animal actually has sinus pause or sinus block with escape, with a junctional escape beat. And you can get into the semantics of that and actually measure the R to R intervals and see if that's a multiple of the normal R to R interval to see if it's block or pause. But in the end, does your patient care? Probably not. Your patient cares that you know that, hey, this ain't right. We need to be treating me with something so I stop passing out. So in this case, you can try a couple of different things to see if there's an underlying cause in this patient. You can try atropine sulfate. We tend to use 1 mL/20 lbs IV. Although IV atropine will temporarily increase atrial ventricular nodal block, that typically will resolve itself. Long-term therapy, if you get an appropriate response to atropine, you can try something like probenthline bromide as a long-term therapy. However, in my experience, even in trying this, I couldn't get past the GI side effects in some patients that didn't want to have pacemakers and things put into their dogs. We would try this, and he basically had either vomiting, diarrhea, anorexia, and actually a couple of patients that we tried. So that tends to be the problem with using this drug. So what is appropriate response to atropine? What should you see in these patients? What should happen to that heart rate if it's related to vagal tone? Yeah, it should jump up. Anybody have a target range idea? At this dose, it should get up to 160 to 180 beats a minute pretty easily. If you're not getting that response in these dogs, if you're getting up to 100 beats a minute, 120, that's probably, that 120 is kind of that gray zone, but 100 beats a minute, 110, that's an inappropriate response to atropine. To me, that suggests that you have cardiac disease as the underlying problem. If he's having clinical signs, fainting episodes, we'll halter him to see if he's having any tachycardic events also. If that's the case, we probably need to be a little bit more aggressive and actually put a pacemaker in that dog, probably. Once again, it's based on the animal's clinical status. I'm not going to jump and put a pacemaker in if he's walking around with this arrhythmia, but he's fine. Okay? Why would I do that? I'm going to use my patient as my guide to decide if I need to use that therapy. If I get appropriate response and I got to try to find, okay, maybe this is a vagal tone. Now I start wondering, okay, why does this animal have increased vagal tone? I start looking for other things and start talking maybe potentially even without a neurologist to see if there's something going on in the brain of this guy. Or he may just be a dog that has high vagal tone. He's nice, relaxed, cool dog, chilled out. You know, it doesn't care. It doesn't bother him one bit. So we have to assess the patients in these guys. Okay. So let's look at AV nodal diseases. So if we look at this patient here, this is an ECG, and I give you the diagnosis so we can try to move on. I know when I'm rambling on, I run behind a little bit. But this guy, notice that he has these P waves. If you look at your ECG here, you have your P wave here, QRST, followed by this lump here that probably shouldn't be there in a normal patient because your T wave is usually nice and it can be biphasic, but it doesn't usually have a two lumps to it. So to me, that suggests that that is a P wave that's being blocked. And if you measure this out, if you look at that interval, that looks like a pretty regular interval in this guy. That P to P interval is pretty regular. So that to me suggests that those are blocked P waves. Now the question you have to ask yourself is that physiologically being blocked? Meaning, is that P wave coming in too early for this patient. And thus, it's being blocked because the AV node is saying, hey, wait a minute, that's too fast. We're not ready to send a signal down to the ventricle. Okay? And chances are, with this patient, it probably is. Okay? But this is still a high-grade second-degree heart block because he's blocking numerous, a high number of those P waves. And we've seen this already a little bit earlier. Look at this guy. What do you guys call this? Third-degree heart block with what type? Ventricular escape beat. Okay? So, soapbox moment. We don't do what? Treat with lidocaine. Very, very good. So this third-degree AV block, and look, you guys should be going, ooh, he didn't give me a complete diagnosis. I just called it third-degree heart block. I forgot my escape beat on here. Okay, I would take off my test on my students' test based on that answer. there's one sitting in here right now, actually. Or one of my ex-students sitting here. Once again, escape beats, I'm beating this drum over the head, you know, a little bit too much here, but life-sustaining rhythms, we're not going to treat with antiarrhythmics, typically slow rates. And these guys, these escape beats are typically slower than normal sinus, ranging from 60 to 40 to 60 beats a minute. They can be junctional or ventricular, junctional again being narrow, ventricular being wide and bizarre-looking QRS complexes. And we saw this diagram a little bit earlier when we talked about interventional things. These patients with high-grade second-degree heart block and third-degree AV block probably need pacemaker therapy. You can try atropine in these dogs. Typically don't work. I will tell you, I do have a patient recently, and if anybody in here can tell me why, besides what we're thinking, that had had third-degree heart block, periods of third-degree heart block, with also periods where he wasn't in third-degree heart block. But he had syncopal episodes, but every time he was on Baytril, he responded and syncopal episodes went away. Took him off Baytril. This dog went through an 8-week course of Baytril therapy, took him off of the Baytril. Within 2 or 3 days, bang, back into third-degree heart block, syncopal episodes again. I don't know. I've looked up everything I can on Baytril to see if it will increase conduction, but my only guess is that this dog has myocarditis, even though it's not presenting that way, so we're testing him for Bartonella and stuff. The dog clinically is perfectly fine if he's not fainting otherwise, so that's the only thing that's against it. So he walks around, wags his tail, and doing fine. We've since actually put a pacemaker in this dog and taken myocardial biopsies to see what's going on with it. It's going to be curious to see what happens and if those come back positive or not, but interesting case. Baytril responsive third-degree heart block. Let's look at some of our tachyarrhythmias. Tachyarrhythmias may also suffer from some of the same problems. You can have disorders of impulse conduction that lead to tachyarrhythmias. Actually, these actually lead to that reentry phenomenon that I'll explain. And you'll go, huh, what does that mean? I'll explain it. I'll try to explain it so that I even can understand it a little bit better. You also have disorders of impulse formation, meaning that you have areas within the heart that don't typically have automaticity, now all of a sudden gain automaticity. So you have that wannabe cell. I want to be a pacemaker cell that decides he wants to start firing, and he fires at inappropriate times and causes very early abnormal beats. Usually they come from either the ventricle. Those are typically the most dangerous ones, or they can come from the atria. And they can become dangerous if they come too fast, but typically those are not as dangerous as ventricular premature beats. And once again, it results in premature complexes on our ECG. So kind of a summary of how I look at premature beats. If I have a normal QRS that tells me it's in supraventricular nature, a single one, it's called an atrial premature complex. I probably don't do anything with that patient if I'm just seeing every you know, a couple of minutes on an ECG while I'm doing an echo. Short runs of greater than 3 of these we call paroxysmal supraventricular tachycardia. These patients I'll probably halter to see if they have a little bit more advanced disease, at least to see if those runs are lasting a little bit longer at times, because I'm concerned that if they are lasting longer, that can actually cause myocardial dysfunction down the line in some patients. So I want to make sure I'm not seeing tachycardia that may result in inducing a cardiomyopathy. And then if I have a patient with a long run, obviously it's long runs of this, I call a supraventricular tachycardia. The same type of system is true for my wide bizarre ventricular beats. With single VPCs, however, especially with certain breeds like boxers, I'll probably hold to those a little bit more aggressively since they're known for having ventricular arrhythmias. I want to make sure that these guys, boxers and Dobermans also, that may be the first signs of cardiomyopathy in those guys. So I tend to hold to them to see if they have more higher numbers of ventricular arrhythmias. Same is true for paroxysmal ventricular tachycardia and ventricular tachycardia. You know, you're not going to worry about Holter, and you're going to start treating that patient probably. So what is this reentry phenomenon thing I'm talking about? Well, in a normal heart, when you look at conduction, it comes down a normal heart. It comes down and basically splits along fibers and basically comes down as a nice, even action potential to depolarize the cells. They'll depolarize these cells evenly, and then these signals will eventually run into each other and die off, okay? And then the cell repolarizes. And in some cases, you know, you have patients that have a complete heart block where those signals come down and they can't get down and depolarize the bottom portions of those cells at all, okay? And then you have some patients that have a bidirectional block on one portion of a myocardium. So you have an area of the myocardium that's not allowing any conduction at all, as if you had like ischemic damage to that area. So the signal comes down, branches, depolarizes the cell, depolarizes this bottom portion, and goes down and depolarizes the rest of the heart, but then comes up to try to depolarize this excitable tissue here, but finds this area to be completely blocked. Okay? And then you have this other group that have what we call a unidirectional block. And it also has slow propagation properties, so that when a signal comes down, it depolarizes one branch, but it finds that this right branch is completely blocked. Won't let it go down antegrade, won't let it go down its direction. However, when it actually comes around, that signal comes around, what it finds is that this other cell, and I'll use my pointer here on my screen since this is actually running out, these cells here are now in a state of allowing polarization to come back up and propagate very slowly through this system. And because it propagates slowly through these tissues, by the time it gets to that top tissue again, it actually finds it excitable. So now all of a sudden, instead of having time for this normal next signal to come down, this tissue is now getting excited from this retrograde flow or retrograde conduction into the upper portion of the system and creates a circuit of depolarization and repolarization that follows this track. And now you have this circuit which we call reentry. Okay? So this is the most common cause of arrhythmias. And the way we treat this is actually by doing one of these two things, by either causing this tissue over here to develop a bidirectional block so that it can't go retrograde back up through this system, or creating a block on both sides of this system. These reentry circuits can actually be what we call macro reentry circuits, meaning they come on a big scale involving areas of the myocardium involving an AV node and what we call an accessory pathway, or they happen on a microscopic level. The most common thought to cause of atrial fibrillation in our patients is using this reentry phenomenon on a very small circuit levels. Okay, instead of having big tissue, you have very small circuits that of reentry that cause atrial fibrillation. Common in it, this results in what we call a narrow complex. Excuse me for one sec. Always come prepared. Been using my pointer a little too much. Narrow complex tachycardia. So what you see in this case is a very regular rhythm in this patient's the narrow complex ECG QRS complexes. And what you may be looking for in this guy is the P waves. Anybody see P waves in this? You probably are not going to see them in a normal position. Because remember, with this retrograde flow, this flow is going in the circuit, going backwards. So the QRS is probably being stimulated at the same time that in these micro reentry circuits, that the atria depolarized. Excuse me, the ventricles are being depolarized at the same time the atria are being depolarized. So your P wave may actually follow your QRS in these patients. And if you look at this patient right here, you see this consistent bump right here that follows, if I can hold my hand still long enough, this consistent bump in a downward slope going into your T wave. That's your P wave in this guy. Okay? So you have a QRS followed by a P morphology. This is a common occurrence with SVTs, is that your P waves get buried within your QRS or follow your QRS complex. Okay? So how do you go about, so this is an SVT, what are you going to do to treat this patient? What's the first thing you're going to do? You have a patient, you come in, you escort this dog. This is an SVT, so this dog is probably standing up looking at you, wagging his tail. Yeah, physiologically try to break them, okay? Vagal maneuvers, okay? Either press on the eyeballs or a combination of rub the carotids, okay? A lot of people say, oh, that's fooey, it doesn't work. Well, actually, the vagal maneuver does work pretty much consistently if you're doing it right in these patients. And how can I tell? When I'm doing it right, these patients go... consistently, they will take a deep breath if I'm doing a vagal maneuver correctly. Okay? However, it may not work to break your arrhythmia. So you have to basically keep trying vagal maneuvers. And if you're not getting that response in your patients, you may not be getting an accurate vagal maneuver in some of these guys. But consistently, when I'm doing a vagal maneuver right, I'll get that deep breath. I told this to my resident recently. In kids, what they actually do is they, in children that are too young to actually tolerate pressing on the eyeballs, part of our training is we have to do a pediatric rotation. And this guy told the owners, but the parents, next time his kid does this and you can't get to the hospital, get a bowl of ice and push his face into it, a bag of ice, okay? Which is basically like jumping into a cold thing of water. What happens? You do this. You jump in the water, you get that rush, and all of a sudden you go, it's the same thing. It's a vagal response, okay? And what you're trying to do is break that rhythm. You're trying to increase vagal tone to the AV node such that you cause a bidirectional block, and all of a sudden you break that rhythm, okay? So that's the goal of using a vagal maneuver in these patients. So the mechanisms of SVTs are twofold. One, you can have either an abnormal site that has gained automaticity, so a site outside of the SA node that all of a sudden starts firing. You can also, this is what we call atrial automatic tachycardia, which means the atrial node basically is just firing and keeps stimulating this AV node, and it's going to shake these down. This signal pathway does not involve the AV node. So in these cases especially, what you may find is that vagal maneuvers or drugs that increase vagal tone don't really break that arrhythmia. What you may see is a slowing of that rhythm, and then it breaks. Okay, as opposed to a rhythm that involves the AV node, you actually, if you increase vagal tone to that area, you may actually completely block that arrhythmia. So what you may see is a blocked P wave at the end of your QRS, end of your tachycardic cycle. So this is the second mechanism where you have that re-entry circuit. So this is the pathway I was telling you about, where you have patients that have the ability to have conduction go retrograde it backwards from the ventricle into the atrium. What you have in this patient, this is classic what we call Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, or an accessory pathway. This accessory pathway is an embryonic remnant that allows electrical signal to get down into the ventricles bypassing the normal AV node. Occasionally, what you find in these patients that before you see that, so on a normal ECG with this patient bypassing the AV node, what you'll see is what we call a ventricular pre-excitation, a shortened PR interval in these guys. When some of these patients develop an atrial premature contraction, what happens is the signal can't get down this pathway because it's still depolarized. So it preferentially goes down an AV node now and then comes back up, depolarized the myocardium. But guess what? Lo and behold, we're ready to take this signal back up into the atrium. And now that creates that circuit we're talking about, okay, of supraventricular tachycardia. So once again, how you treat these patients, vagal maneuvers try to increase vagal tone to the AV node, or we do drug therapy that slows the ventricular response rate, so we target the AV node in these patients, okay? So instead of being able to break the rhythm, we try to slow the ventricular response rate to improve our hemodynamics in these patients. What you may see is that we may break the SVT rhythm using this nodal pathway, and that would suggest that the AV node is involved in that pathway. Drug therapy would include the class 1As or class 3 drugs. Procainamide or Sololol are probably the two most commonly used. You can also add an amiodarone to that mix as a class 3 drug. Typically, if we have an SVT that doesn't respond to vagal maneuvers, I tend to start with procainamide, okay, to try to break that rhythm. Obviously, Sololol is an orally formulated drug. I give a loading dose of procainamide, 6 to 8 milligrams IV dose. I will give a bolus, a slow IV bolus, and tend to do probably 2 or 3 boluses before I give up on that drug. The thing about procainamide is you have to be ready to put these animals on a continuous rate infusion, because it may break that rhythm, but if their drug levels, once those drug levels drop down, which they do very rapidly, you may lose control of that rhythm again. So the idea of the bolus is to get us up to drug levels, and then we put them on a continuous rate infusion to keep us at that level. One of the common mistakes we see our students make is that they'll take these dogs off the drips, take them for a walk, and then come back in and hook them back up to the drip without giving them another bolus. So they never really get back up to drug levels again. And what we find is that they escape from arrhythmia, and everybody's wondering why, and then you go back and look at the chart and you say, oh, they didn't re-bolus the animal to get the drug levels back up after they've been off of their drip. So that's a common thing that occurs in these guys. The other drug that you may have available in the IV formulation, if you're close to a human hospital or pharmacy, is the amiodarone if you're having trouble breaking these rhythms. The idea of both of these drugs is that they prolong our action potential duration. They prolong it such that that signal that's trying to come back around now all of a sudden finds that tissue non-excitable. And because it finds it non-excitable, you've basically created that bidirectional block, and thus you break that rhythm. Whether it's a micro or macro reentrant type of arrhythmia, that's what you see with both of these classes of drugs. Another key component, these drugs, because they both prolong action potential duration, you should not use these in combination with each other. You can cause a deadly arrhythmia by prolonging the QT interval too long, called torsadic points, a form of ventricular fibrillation. Okay, so we never really use these drugs in combination together to try to treat these patients. So the response to the vagal maneuver are the class 1A drugs, because these are ones that will break that rhythm, will tell us a couple of different things. It may end up blocking a P wave. As you see right here, this is your P wave right here in these patients. We know that at minimum, the AV node is involved some type of way in this circuit. It may be that you have an accessory pathway, but it may also be that that you have an AV nodal reentry type of circuit that's going on. The indications that we have as far as having an accessory pathway is once we break that rhythm, we have ventricular pre-excitation. As you see here, the PR interval in this patient following blocking this is very short in this guy. In this case, we have another treatment option for this patient. Okay? We can send this patient off to get electrophysiologic studies performed. And basically what we can do is find this AV, this accessory pathway by stimulating the heart and finding the shortest interval that the ventricles get stimulated. We do that using a multi-lead electrode that we put into the heart. And then we can take that another lead and actually go find it close to that area where we found that heart and actually fry that node, fry that accessory pathway. That obviates the need for any antiarrhythmic therapy in that patient. Okay? Oftentimes, what it does do is uncover another accessory pathway in these guys, and you can go back in and ablate that one. It's actually a pretty tedious process to do, but you have a couple of cardiologists, 3 or 4 in the country, who are very interested in doing these things. And what it results in, basically, this radio frequency ablation is basically a little small scar on a heart, basically where we've blocked that tissue from allowing conduction. Okay? Otherwise, these patients are pretty normal. So once again, now you've completely cured a patient and you don't need to have chronic drug therapy, which can actually exacerbate some arrhythmias in these guys. Okay? chronic oral therapy for these patients, I tend to use Solarol the most for these patients, but you can use procainamide orally. Ideally, Solarol is used because it is mostly used because it's a twice-a-day therapy. Most of the other drugs like procainamide are 3 to 4 times a day, depending on which formulation that you use. So oftentimes, these patients miss a dose. Okay, Solarol will prolong the action potential duration of atrial myocytes to break the circuit. It also will give us some benefit at the AV nodal region. Well, what if I can't break this arrhythmia? Okay, what if none of my drugs work and I have a problem with sending this for an EP study? Well, then I want drugs that affect the AV node, that slow AV node conduction. So in that case, you can use drugs like calcium channel blockers like diltiazem or beta blockers like atenolol and dindroxin in combination to slow the ventricular response rate, improve our hemodynamics. These patients will do very well on that. Another emergency therapy treatment that you could potentially use is another beta blocker called esmolol. It's an IV formulation, very short-acting drug in these guys. Oftentimes may not break the arrhythmia, but will slow it down significantly. There is also an IV formulation of diltiazem in these guys, but if you look up doses of diltiazem, you really have to play around to find the right dose because there's no really good IV formulation dose of that drug. So what we'll do in these patients that we can't break the arrhythmia is we'll use a combination, especially those that don't have underlying cardiomyopathy. We'll probably use beta blockers first. If they have cardiomyopathy, I use digoxin and diltiazem as a combination. Those with cardiomyopathies don't really respond well to beta blockers. Their heart rates do, but the heart failure doesn't. They tend to go back into heart failure. You send these guys into heart failure with beta blockers. So I tend to avoid those in these guys with advanced cardiac disease. What about dysarrhythmia? What do you guys think of this one? Like, I try not to, is what you're saying, but notice that this rhythm is very rapid, very irregular in nature. You have periods of regularity followed by periods of irregularity. Can't speak anymore. It's just no pattern to it, and then you can't really find any discernible P waves in this guy, anything that consistently looks like a P wave. I'll tell you that this rhythm sounds like this. What do you think that is? AFib, okay? Sounds like tennis shoes in a dryer. So atrial fibrillation. So classically on our ECGs, no discernible P waves, very irregular ventricular response rate, often associated with underlying heart disease, although there's a larger group of dogs than we know of that actually has what we call primary atrial fibrillation. That's all they have. They don't have cardiomyopathy. They just have atrial fibrillation. The breed for that, anybody knows? Irish Wolfhounds. Okay, they will have long atrial fibrillation and may not necessarily have cardiomyopathy associated with that. This often can lead to numerous self-sustaining, as a result of numerous self-sustaining micro reentrants. Okay, so you have all of these little micro reentries going on in these patients. So when you look at them, atrial fibrillation is basically all these little small self-sustaining reentry circuits that are basically bombarding the AV node. And because if you have an animal with a healthy AV node, it's going to take as many of those as it can, but the irregular response comes in the fact that the AV node is going to block some of these, and then it's going to let some of them through, and it's going to let some of them through faster and some of them through slower. And it also is relying upon what your underlying vagal tone is. If you have high vagal tone, it's going to slow that rate down. If you have high sympathetic tone, more of those signals are going to get through a healthy AV node patient. Atrial fibrillation patient. So what are the goals? The ultimate goal of treating an atrial fibrillation patient would be to convert them back to sinus rhythm. Well, ideally there are drugs that can do that. The class 1A drugs such as quinidine can do that. Anybody ever tried this for atrial fibrillation patient in dogs? You should. If you don't have underlying cardiomyopathy and the dog goes into atrial fibrillation, and you can figure out when it went into atrial fibrillation, especially if it's hasn't been a long duration, quinidine may actually convert these guys. Okay, we've done it in dogs with massive atrias and and converted some of these guys. Now, the problem is they don't stay out of AFib. The longest we've got a dog with a huge atria to stay out of AFib with this drug, it's been 6 months. Okay? So chances are within the first month or 2 or 3 months, they'll go back into atrial fibrillation. You can also try the class 3 drugs. There's a nice paper out of Texas A&M that shows amiodarone as a potential drug that converts converts these atrial fibrillation patients back into a sinus rhythm. Okay? However, it's only about, we only see this probably about 30% of patients. The other thing that we can do is something called cardioversion, which is very popular here in Colorado area. Jan Bright is the one that does this the most in these patients. The goal, if we can't convert them, then it becomes, again, slowing the ventricular response rate at the AV node. We use calcium channel blockers like diltiazem or beta blockers like atenolol to slow down the AV nodal response. Or in patients with cardiomyopathy, we'll use, again, a combination of digoxin and diltiazem to try to slow the AV nodal response in these patients. Okay? And the goal for us is to try to get the the ventricular response rate down close to about 100 to 120 beats per minute. Now, oftentimes we can't figure that out with these animals in the hospital, so we end up, once we start treating these guys, we do a Holter monitor on them to assess what their heart rate is at home before we start bumping up doses on these guys and they start becoming flat out from it. So we halter them send them home with a halter, see what their underlying heart rate is. If we're getting them at 100, 120 beats a minute, we're happy with that. If they're popping around 140, 160 at home, we probably don't have very good control of that rhythm, so we may need to increase probably most often the calcium channel blocker therapy in these patients. Advanced therapies that we're looking at nowadays is actually ablating the AV node if we can't convert atrial fibrillation. We can go in and actually cause a radio frequency ablation of the AV node and follow that up with a pacemaker in these patients. Once again, about 4 or 5 cardiologists are actually looking into that right now to assess if we're getting the benefits of our patients with that drug. And then the biphasic cardioversion, Jan Bright has been shown that we can actually convert 92% of atrial fibrillation patients by giving us appropriately timed stimulus and cardioverting them back over. And what she's found is that these dogs that don't have a lot of underlying heart disease will stay out of atrial fibrillation as long as 700 days in some of these patients. But those that have advanced myocardial disease tend to come back in to AFib. Here's a patient with ventricular tachycardia. Okay? What's your treatment of choice for this? Depends on the underlying cause, obviously, but IV lidocaine or procainamide should do the trick in these patients. These basically, ventricular tachycardias originate from ectopic focus within the ventricle, often result in significant compromise of the hemodynamic function, and it's very detrimental to myocardial function. Treatment protocols for our patients with ventricular origin, if they're unifocal, not many of them, we'll halt them to assess for if we really need to be treating these patients. If they're multifocal, obviously, we'll try class 1 drugs, either lidocaine or procainamide. Orally, we'll try procainamide. Class 2 drugs plus class 1B plus a class 2 drugs seem to be one of the favorite effects. There's a nice study that came out of ACVIM recently that looked at the ability of solanezumab as a class 3 lung drug to control long-term ventricular fibrillation. What we found is that solanezumab hasn't really been doing the trick in a lot of these patients, as opposed to using mexiletine and atenolol. What I've done in these patients that I don't control very well is I've bumped up the dose to a little bit higher than a typical dosing range, which is 1 to 3 mg per kilogram. And I've even given solanezumab 3 times a day to try to control it, rather than to try to use multiple drug therapy. But sometimes I fall back and use mexiletine and atenolol in our patients. Obviously, unstable patients, IV drugs plus sustained drips are going to be very important in these patients, either IV procainamide or IV lidocaine. In patients that have disease such as hit by car, have sick myocardiums, the lidocaine may be a little bit more beneficial in using than the procainamide. We may see more benefit in these patients. Any other causes, treat the underlying causes. A large percentage of these patients have extracardiac causes to these ventricular arrhythmias. I think my time is up. And at the end of this, they're giving you guys these talks I've made all my talks available on CD. And at the end of this, I have like a bunch of things that we use, protocols that we use for specific arrhythmias that we give our students as far as treating these patients, and you can see them here. So hopefully you can help. This will be a helpful guide for you guys when you're treating these arrhythmias. And don't forget about some of these newer technologies that are coming out that are really curing these patients from having these arrhythmias. So with that, take any questions that you have. Yes, sir. Everybody here hear the question. With anesthetized patients that are throwing some VPCs, how many of those do I consider, or at what point would I consider treating those? If I'm seeing multiple runs of couplets and triplets of ventricular arrhythmias, then I will start treating them. If I'm seeing a single uniform PVC, every couple of minutes, I'm not going to be worried about them, especially if my blood pressure and everything is staying normal in those patients. So I probably hold off until I start seeing more advanced arrhythmias. I start seeing them very frequently, or couplets or RNT phenomena in those guys. Every 30 seconds or so, every 10 seconds or so, I probably start reaching for the drug then at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Yes. So the question is the difference in a beta blocker using metoprolol over Sotalol. And those are two different classes actually out here, drugs. Sotalol is actually a class 3 antiarrhythmic. So it gives us actually blocking properties of the potassium channel as well as some beta blocking properties. Whereas metoprolol just has class 2 antiarrhythmic properties. So those drugs, even though Sotalol ends in an OL, it's really a class 3 and has some other properties that's beneficial for those patients. But for animals that I'm trying to slow down AV nodal response, I can reach for something like metoprolol. Atenolol is probably my drug of choice for doing that. So, thank you guys very much.